I don't ever think of myself as a salesperson. I'm offering opportunities and people are choosing to buy those opportunities. So when somebody's coming into my organization to work for me, they're buying into my company because what I've shown them is something that they want to be part of.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
All right, Mark, welcome to the podcast. Happy to have you on, man.
Hey, Justin, thanks so much for having me. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, no, let's kind of jump right in. You and I actually haven't met yet, even though we're beard brothers, it feels right. Like. So for those of you listening, we both have pretty large beards. But yeah, give us kind of your quick intro, who you are, what you're up to, and then we'll dive into some stuff.
Sure. I am totally addicted to real estate. I have been since I bought my first investment property back in 08. I actually came to Rochester from Central Pennsylvania to go to RIT. And I worked in industry, went through, got my bachelor's of science, worked a little bit, went back, got my master's of science, got laid off when they lost this legacy contract, laid off 2,000 people with similar background to me. And at that point, I decided to transition to real estate full time. I probably had a half dozen to a dozen rentals under my belt. I was self-managing them. I had a small crew of guys that, you know, I would 1099 contract them, but I would work beside them every day. And we would buy pretty distressed properties and fix them up, and I would put them in my portfolio. And when I made that switch from W-2 to the more passive slash active real estate world, I didn't have enough cash flow to replace my W-2 income. So I really needed to figure out a way to be able to still put food on the table. So I decided to get licensed as a realtor. And doing that, I had absolutely no experience in sales. I didn't like realtors. Anytime that I worked with one, they were constantly trying to shove something down my throat. And I knew what I wanted. And maybe I was a little bit picky, but that was kind of my impression of realtors, was that they were like used car salesmen. So for me to get licensed as a realtor, my wife was like, dude, are you crazy? You don't like realtors. What are you thinking? And I was just like, well, you know, if it doesn't work out, then we will pivot and I'll figure something else out, but I'll give it the old college try. Yeah. And she kind of laughed and shrugged it off and said, all right, you're not going to have much time, so you better get out there and do it. I got licensed. I hung my license with a broker where they don't charge you very much. It was at the Remax franchise, which okay. If you know real estate sales, you get 95% of your commission, but you have to pay $1,000 desk fee. So it costs you 12 grand a year. And everybody said, hey, is that the best model for you? Like, why don't you go to a different model where you get 70% of your commission and, you know, they'll take 30%, but there's no dues. Mm-hmm. And I politely said, like, I thought this through, like, I'm going to sink or swim, right? And if I'm not swimming, then I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to take the Remax model. I'm going to go for it. And then I'm going to reevaluate in a year. And that first year, you know, I only did like $1.5 million. Okay. You know, so it didn't replace my W-2 income, but it gave me a taste of the process working with people. And the feedback that I got from them was like, hey, you know, we like working with you because you're not that typical realtor. You're educating us. You're actually probably doing more work than you have to because you're telling us not to buy this and not to buy that. And here's why.
Yeah.
So with that feedback, I was like, okay, maybe I can scale that, you know, the 1.5, because I was still managing, I was still doing construction stuff, and I wasn't really working in the real estate field full time. So over my next 2 years, I did some advertising through sites like Zillow and BiggerPockets, and my sales increased from 1.5 million to 5 million pretty quickly. Wow. You know, I got the attention of my broker. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm not really doing anything other than answering the phone and doing my job. And I treat it like ping pong, right? So if something came at me, I would just hit it back. That's customer service. So if you're good at customer service, you'll do good sales. And as I progressed, I got close to 10 million within like 4 years of being in the business. The people that were working for me, because I still had my properties to manage. So I brought some people on payroll to do that, to help me do that. They were like, holy cow, we want to be in sales too, because you're just making it look so easy. And so that's when I said, all right, well, maybe I should set up my own brokerage. And that's what I did. I set one up for sales and I set one up for the management side, because not only would the people that were working for me wanted to get into sales, I had clients that were buying stuff that wanted me to manage.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Realistically, I was like, okay, it just makes sense to part ways with Remax, open up my own shop. And that way we can kind of control the experience for the consumer. And that's what led ultimately to adding on that general contracting arm, was because the same thing with contractors. It's like, if you can find a good one, they're super expensive. You're at their mercy of their schedule, right? And sometimes they'll overbook and they'll commit. And then, you know, all of a sudden you can put penalties in place, but ultimately, like, you got to get the job done and you got to have relationships that last and you got to be able to move the ball forward. So for us, we decided to bring that in-house. And it's not that we do everything in-house, but we have enough of a force in-house that I can direct people to get stuff done as needed, right? Whether it's somebody wants a listing, somebody's doing a burr, somebody's doing a flip or whatever, I have that control. So that's kind of how I got into real estate. And I would tell you, after I bought my first one, I was just totally hooked.
No, that's awesome. There's a lot to unpack there, but I got to ask you, first of all, you said you moved from Central PA. Where in Central PA?
Williamsport, the home of the Little League World Series.
Got it. So I grew up near Lewisburg, Sealands Grove. So I know Williamsport very, very well. We can talk about Central PA and all its glory offline. But yes. So you moved to Rochester, bought your first property, like, and was that first property an investment property or was that kind of your primary residence?
I think it was both, actually. We bought our primary and I bought my first investment property the same year.
Got it. What kind of triggered or gave you kind of the guidance or insight to say, I want to start investing in real estate? Like, how did that happen exactly?
Yeah, as cliche as it is, it was like the Rich Dad Poor Dad series. You know, I was still getting my master's. I was consuming as much material about investing as possible. And originally I was in stocks, right? And I would put money in stocks and I was constantly checking these tickers, and I didn't feel like it was what I wanted to be doing as far as how I was investing. I thought it was a little bit speculative. It was kind of at the mercy of the overall markets and geopolitics and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's when I got into the real estate side of things and reading a bunch of real estate books. When that mind shift happened, I kept saving. And then as soon as I had enough money to get into real estate, I started deploying my capital into real estate.
Got it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's kind of, I was a little bit later to the party than you were, but the Rich Dad Poor Dad kind of mindset shift was just like a light bulb moment of like, wait, there's a different model. There's a different option as opposed to just investing in the stock market or your company's 401k. There are all these other things that you can get access to, but also it generates passive income, right? So that's ultimately the goal. So that first property, was it single family? Was it a 2-4 unit? Like, what did you kind of start out with?
I started with a simple single. You know, we purchased it for $55,000, did about $10,000 in rehab. Of course, I had all my tools stolen. This was when, back in the day, when I would still change toilets and get up on the roof. And so it was a pretty big blow to have all of your tools stolen at once. That sunk my sale a little bit, but I didn't let it discourage me.
Yeah.
And of course, the day that it got stolen, we had like 3 feet of snow and I had been working until like midnight. And left during the blizzard. And I was like, nobody's going to bother this stuff. It's right. The middle of a blizzard. Sure enough, that was the day that they decided to break in and take everything.
Unreal. Yeah, that is definitely a kick in the pants as you're kind of doing work and trying to, you know, beat a blizzard. So I want to kind of dig into kind of the transition from W-2 to full-time real estate. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, and we've got Mark on the pod. So before the break, we were kind of talking about that first property you bought, the single family. Unfortunately, had your tools stolen, which is not an ideal start to the investing journey because obviously tools are very, very expensive. But how did you kind of keep acquiring? Sounds like you were working and kind of just saving and buying and saving and buying, right? Is that kind of the model that you kind of started out with?
Yeah. And I did a bunch of side hustles to save extra cash. You know, so not only did I tighten up what I spent my money on, like no more iced coffees at Dunkin' Donuts, I'm buying whole bean and making my own little life hacks like that, obviously. But then I got into a couple side hustles and it just got lucky. You know, my father worked for Pepsi-Cola and it was right at the time when they were changing technologies from the Cornelius kegs into bag in a box. So now all the fountain soda is actually in a plastic bag in a box. Yeah. And I was down visiting him and he's like, some of his guys ripping the rubber off these Cornelius kegs, throwing the rubber in a pile and throwing the stainless in a pile. And I'm like, what are they doing? He's like, oh, you know, Pepsi's paying me to have these kegs disassembled so they can scrap the stainless and get the scrap price. And so I'm thinking to myself, every 20 something in America is all about homebrewing right now, and they all need these Cornelius kegs. I said, why don't you make them an offer? Let's see if we can buy these Cornelius kegs for the scrap price, and then they'll save on you having to get paid to rip the rubber off.
To actually disassemble them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they're like, yeah, absolutely. You can take it for scrap price. So I bought all of the kegs that they had in the warehouse. And luckily my father partnered with me on that venture because I didn't have the capital to buy them. So we bought them together. And then once we sold them all, which was very quickly, I'd tell you within like 6 months, I had to clean them and package them. There's a whole long story behind that. But
yeah,
we took all that capital, and that's what got us together as partners into two more houses. So I started scaling just by doing different little bootstrap stuff. You know, I had like a glass blowing business of my own. I made jewelry, and then I would go to festivals and sell it. And I quickly learned that ladies love really pretty jewelry to wear, and they'll pay a huge premium for it. So I had that down to where, you know, I'd spend about 15 minutes making a piece, and I could sell it for like 100, 150 bucks. And so that was some pretty good cash flow.
Pretty good hourly rate. Yeah. That's interesting. So how did you get into glass blowing? I know this is a real estate podcast, but I actually watched a couple of glass blowing TV shows, which is super fascinating.
Yeah. So at RIT, they've got a really big glass blowing department. And luckily we were allowed to pick electives, whatever we wanted. And one of the electives I took was flame working, which is glass blowing with a flame. Mm-hmm. And I just got hooked on it. And so after I took that course, I set up a small studio in my garage, and I just kind of learned on my own and developed my own style. And then over the years, I had all this inventory, and my wife's like, you know, she would wear a lot of it, but she can't wear all of it. There was way too much of it. And she's like, All right, you gotta start selling this, or you can't afford this hobby because you got to buy all the supplies, right? So As soon as I started selling it at festivals, I was like, okay, this will actually not only pay for itself, but it'll actually be kind of profitable.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to kind of dig into, because I think it's interesting, is that kind of shift from, okay, I'm working a W-2 and I'm investing and managing all your properties. And then you're like, okay, I want to figure out getting out of my W-2, right? And you said earlier that when you decided to make the switch to full-time real estate, you didn't have enough cash flow to replace your W-2 income, right? And so it sounds like you have a family, which obviously you need to provide for. Like, how did that conversation happen between the family of like, you know, hey, this is the path that I think we should go down as a unit, right? As a team, but there's going to be some potential kind of hardships in the beginning, right? Because you couldn't offset your cash flow. So how did those conversations happen? Because my wife and I kind of had the similar conversation when I decided to quit my W-2 right before the pandemic, but I'm curious kind of your story.
Yeah. So luckily we did not have kids yet when I started, and my wife was pretty supportive. You know, she was working, and she basically gave me permission to give it a shot because I think she trusts me a lot on like the numbers and stuff. It kind of bores her if I'm like, oh, You know, I'm going through the pro forma. She's just like, okay, you know, she's more worried about what if they don't pay and what if they trash it? Like, she doesn't care about a pro forma. She's like high level, like they might not pay, they might trash it, you could be screwed. So that was always the conversation. And I'm like, okay, yes, it is risky. But after I did a couple transactions where I made some good money, you know, in hindsight, I probably would have kept a lot of things and not sold stuff, but I have sold things over the years. And when you get that win of like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and you can show that to your spouse and say, look, here's the proof that this system works. And then kind of like educating her as far as like, okay, we could sell things a lot and have these checks, $20,000, $30,000 coming in, or we could stack them up. And then when we retire, now we've got 50 of them sitting on the sideline. And instead of being $20,000 or $30,000 a piece, now the mortgage has been paid down a lot and we're actually bringing in a lot more money at retirement versus like taking that cash today. So I think having the more high level conversations about it versus like getting into the weeds, because whenever I got into the weeds with her, that wasn't the right conversation with her. She's not, opposites attract, right? And so I think trying to explain something to your spouse, if you are that opposites attract, it's not going to work. You got to kind of go for the high level, and there's going to have to be a level of trust. And then obviously a little bit of proof in the pudding.
Yeah. You got to talk their language and give them the nuts and bolts. I think that makes a ton of sense. So talk us through kind of that transition from the full-time W-2 to real estate professional and full-time real estate, because you kind of had to do some things that you maybe weren't super interested in, being a real estate agent and selling and all of that, and kind of lead us kind of up to almost present day of kind of what you've got going on. Cause it sounds like you've got a number of different entities. So I'm also curious kind of about how you manage all of that and staff and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And thinking about it now, I would tell you that like sales is really key. So I'm really glad that I did that. And that's probably what propelled me in my other business ventures is having that really strong sales, customer service experience, right? So getting into the sales side and working around your client's schedule, a lot of these real estate sales happened in off hours. So during the day, I'm doing my management, I'm doing my fix and flips. And then in the evening, I'm running around showing houses. So my wife wasn't super happy about that.
Yeah.
We didn't have kids yet. So I think like it was good that I put the work in early and could do that. Right. And now I can kind of like manage my schedule a little bit more with work-life balance. But yeah, having that sales has really helped me build my business, hire people, because I really think that everything almost comes back to sales. Even when you're hiring somebody, they're buying a position with you. You're quote selling a position. I don't ever think of myself as a salesperson. I'm offering opportunities and people are choosing to buy those opportunities. So when somebody's coming into my organization to work for me, they're buying into my company because what I've shown them is something that they want to be part of. And so having that background, we've been able to have a lot of clients that are repeat. They've been with us forever. And once we get people, they don't tend to leave because we take care of them. So that's going to feed a lot of different avenues in real estate. We try to be a full service suite. So we can help them with the brokerage. We can help them, you know, both on the acquisition side, on the sales side, we can manage it. We can get their values up by increasing their rents and having a good plan for their property as far as CapEx over time and really strategically positioning them in the marketplace as far as timing, and then all the way through to the, you know, improvements, like what improvements should we do? What's going to be our best bang for our buck? What shouldn't we do? When should we do it? All those kind of questions. And just having that sales experience has really helped me to position myself to be able to capture the market, because not many people are good at sales.
And also, I would imagine there's not a lot of agents out there that are entirely full service, right? So I'm curious a little bit about your clientele. Are they like primary house hunters, or are they investors looking for investments? Because it sounds like you could almost be a turnkey service where, you know, I'm an out-of-state investor. I live in Austin, and I could say, hey, I'm really interested in Rochester as an investment. How do we find a single family or a 2-4 unit that you tell me where to look? And if it's a good price, and then I'm going to turn it over to you to manage, and you're going to tell me what rents are, because you're obviously renting out other properties. So that was a really long-winded question of who's your kind of agent demographic, or who's your kind of who you're targeting in that space.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we have everybody from our next door neighbor to people in Austin. I'd say it's probably about 50-50 as far as like retail sales, just normal people buying and selling houses, and then 50% investors. Of the investors, some are going to be local, some are not. I would tell you we have probably more that are not local than we do have that are local for whatever reason. You know, Rochester's a pretty good marketplace. So I think a lot of people come here because the fundamentals are pretty good as far as cash flow goes.
Yeah.
And so I have those conversations all the time. I've trained my agents on how to handle it. And we've got a good lead system where I'm a pretty good like ISA, internal sales agent, where I can have that first conversation with people. I can get them into the database. I can explain to them how our process works. And then I can have people under me that are taking care of the day-to-day operations as far as running around, showing houses, taking photographs, doing FaceTimes, et cetera.
Got it. And then I guess, are you kind of from an investment standpoint? So let's talk a little about some of the other investments that you're looking at. Are you still in kind of the single family? Have you gone into syndications? Like, talk us through kind of the evolution, because sometimes people kind of start their journey at in single family or 2-4 unit, and then they graduate to 10 to 20 units and then 100 units. Mm-hmm. Like, what's that evolution been like for you?
Yeah. So I'm always looking for the lowest hanging fruit and I'll grab it. So for a long time in my marketplace, the 1-4 family market was it.
Okay.
The returns were just so good. And it's going to be based on your geography. We were turn of the century architecture. And so we've got a lot of 1-4 family. Once you get past 1-4 family, you know, it kind of jumps to like 8-20 unit.
Okay.
And they're few and far between. I'm very location centric when I invest. So if I were going to say, hey, I'm going to jump into this 8-20 family market or 20-40 family market, there's not enough opportunities for me to be able to buy, right? Because I'm not going to buy some stuff that's in an area that I don't agree with. So for me, it's all location versus unit count, as long as the price per unit is what works for my pro forma. Obviously, I would like to be buying larger and larger assets when they come up. So I have scaled as I've gotten older and I've had more capital. But I would tell you that I'm still not going to turn down singles if they make sense. You know, so if I go to a city auction, they're primarily going to be singles. Of the 2,000 properties that get auctioned off each year, 90% are single families, 10% are going to be multifamilies. So if you look at it from that perspective, in my opinion, for me, I'd be silly not to take advantage of those when I'm buying 60 cents on the dollar. I could keep them as a cash flow rental, or I could flip them for a profit. It's a little bit more work because if I'm buying 100 properties to get 100 doors, now I've got 100 different roofs. I've got 100 different locations.
Yeah.
But you know, because we've been doing it so long, I feel like we know that model really, really well. So yeah, I would tell you just because of where I'm at, I'm kind of pigeonholed into smaller deals, unfortunately.
Got it. And I know that you do like some, do you also get into like the development side? Like have you kind of built and developed kind of the single family or any of that space?
Yeah. So I'm converting an office in our downtown core. It was 16,000 square feet. We got tons of underutilized office, vacant office downtown. So I purchased a building from a company that had moved out. I got a good price on it and I'm turning that into luxury lofts. So we completely demoed it. The building is a concrete tank, you know, it's all concrete construction. And so it'll be pretty easy to put it back together. We've just got through our demo phase and the framers are going to start. Expected completion is probably like May of next year.
Got it. I think it was the city of Boston has so many vacant buildings or vacant office spaces that they're providing like tax incentives, I think, to developers to convert them into apartments or condos. So was there any kind of, I guess, offer from Rochester on like, hey, can you convert or can somebody convert this into apartments just because we don't have enough living space? Or is that just kind of your strategy that you kind of figured was made sense?
That was my strategy, but there was an incentive that like after I purchased the building, they announced this district and once in a while, these districts will pop up. For us, it was like about a 1 mile radius, not a radius, like a half mile radius, 1 mile diameter circle in Center City. And if you were within that sphere, you were eligible for 20% state, 20% federal credit. And I went through the whole process. And unfortunately, I was denied because my facade was put on in 1987 and the cutoff was like 1984. And so by 3 years, I missed the eligibility. It would have been huge on my pro forma to be able to take advantage of that. And I fought it, but what it came down to was like, if I wanted to take advantage of it, they wanted me to rip my facade off. And the facade that I have on my building was actually built to look old. So I didn't even know it was that new. I just always assumed it was older. And they're like, no, it was put on in 87 to mimic this old architecture. And if you want the grant, you got to rip it off. And I had like a brick warehouse originally, right? The building was built as a warehouse to manufacture furniture.
Yeah.
It would have been ugly. And so the credit would have just been wasted ripping a facade off and putting a new facade on. So it wasn't worth it.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I feel like I'm glad that I never went down the investing into office space route just because it seems like that's not the place to be at the moment. I have a recruiting business, so that's my background. So it's like, I see a lot of, obviously my clients are going hybrid and work remote first and all that fun stuff. So that should be an interesting project. I'm curious a little bit about the mindset around some people listening to this podcast are maybe early or kind of just building their portfolio. And, you know, they're typically hardworking folks. They have a W-2 or they run a business. And so they don't have the time to do what you did and kind of, you know, fix toilets and deal with tenants and trash and all that fun stuff, which are a lot of the reasons why people don't get into real estate investing. But if you were like going to be passive and invest passively, like what are some of the things that you would do to kind of get started if you had to restart your journey kind of back when you were a W-2?
Ooh, this market is tough to start in. I mean, I would probably focus on foreclosures, honestly. Mm-hmm. Foreclosures, maybe pre-foreclosure, if you can get into that, help them work out a solution. I know there's a lot of businesses that set up win-win solutions for people that are facing foreclosure, where as an investor, you can go in and maybe do like an equity split with them. So let's say your house is worth 400, you owe 200, you can't make your payments. You give them a lease option to purchase it back from you in like 2 years after they get their finances in order and you split the equity. There's different methodologies, but I think if you want to get something with a little bit of meat on the bone, you either need to get into larger multifamily and wait for that to start to come down because we all think that there's going to be some correction in that space, given that there was a lot of kind of risky underwriting that was taking place. So yeah, I would probably save up as much money as possible to try to get in either A, get in some larger deals, or B, be able to do cash transactions for distressed sales, people that are facing foreclosure, maybe at the auction or prior to the auction.
I actually haven't gone down the pre-foreclosure, foreclosure route. I think I've talked to a few people, that's kind of their model, and it hasn't been something that I've necessarily focused on. I think you mentioned, or in your bio, you talk about being like a coach and a mentor. Are you kind of helping to coach kind of newbie investors, or maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do it all pro bono because I didn't really have anybody helping me when I got into this business. And luckily, I made a lot of friends and I could rely on them for their expertise, where I wasn't like overly bothering them. But if I had a tough question, I had somebody in my Rolodex that I could call that would answer it for me. Yeah. And so I've just kind of amassed all this knowledge in all these different spaces. So whenever I have somebody that reaches out to me that's like, hey, I want to get into real estate, I take them under my wing. And if they're willing to put in the work, I'm willing to sit there and spoon feed them. It's just so fun for me to watch people have success in real estate and like have the same experience that I have and the same feelings that I have about it. So I have one gentleman that just started with me not too long ago, and I had him in the office the other night. He's brand new. He really wants to quit his job. I'm like, don't quit your job yet.
Not yet.
Let's make sure that this is going to work for you. I made a couple cold calls, and you know, I've been doing it for years. And I'd get off the phone. He's like, wow, you're so good at that. I'm like, it's easy. Just take a deep breath. Now it's your turn. And then the first call that he gets on, he looks at me and I'm like smiling at him. And he just starts laughing. He starts like busting up laughing. And then so I take over the call. It's on speakerphone. And it was one that we actually set up an appointment for. So we had done like probably made 20 dials and we hadn't made any appointments. And the one that he like tries to go on and totally screws up is the one that we end up making the appointment. He got bit by the bug just doing that. He saw how it's really not that hard. You just have to go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's one of those things where you put in the effort, and that's awesome that you kind of provide free kind of coaching to folks and give them the tools that you wish you probably had it when you started out, right? You had to kind of figure it out. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to start this podcast is because we grew up about an hour away from each other, Central PA, and I didn't have any real estate kind of coaching or exposure from an investing standpoint growing up or even until I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, frankly. And so I want to use this platform as the ability for me to kind of share people's stories like yours of like, hey, you can go down the multifamily route. You can go down the single family route and build businesses and all that. There's other options out there is kind of the main focus. So, you know, we're recording this podcast in August 2023. Obviously, we're in a very high interest rate market at the moment. I guess you're kind of focused on the 1-4 unit, obviously, because that's where you're investing in your geography. What are you kind of seeing? What are your kind of outlooks for the rest of 23, maybe 24? Like, give me kind of your crystal ball predictions on and where maybe you're focused.
Yeah. So I'm gearing up to get into the larger multifamily. It'll probably not necessarily be in Rochester. You know, we're not a very landlord friendly state. Number one. Number two, what we already talked about, the inventory is just kind of like the stuff that is available is pretty beat up and deferred, old legacy slumlord type stuff. So what I'm doing now is I'm starting a blind fund for foreclosures because I'm really good at foreclosures. We're typically purchasing like 50 cents on the dollar. And I've been doing that for years, just kind of by myself. And people have always been interested in it. And I've always educated them on how I do it and what the process is. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And nobody's ever really followed in my footsteps. Just, I think the barrier to entry is just so high. And a lot of times people are busy or whatever. They want a good investment, but like foreclosures just don't end up working out for them, even though I love them. Right. And so my idea is I will set up the blind funds. I'll go back to a lot of these people that I already know and say, hey, you can now invest in foreclosures through my blind funds.
Right.
And then instead of
I do all the work, you make the returns kind of a thing. Yeah.
So instead of buying 10 properties a year, hopefully I can scale that. And now I'm buying like 100 properties. And then ultimately I want to prove to them that like, hey, you saw my track record. That's why you signed up for the blind fund. I've executed it. You've gotten excellent returns. Now let's take it to the next level. Let's get into some, I want to do a blind fund for multifamily. So when those do start to hit the fan, I can be there to scoop them up.
Yeah. And I think I was talking to somebody earlier today that is mainly focused on syndication, which is where I really tread right now. And there is some distress in the market, but sellers are still looking for premiums like they did in 2021. And they're not kind of accepting that they just can't sell the property for what they valued it in 2021. So there is some, I'm seeing some kind of decrease in what they're asking for, especially on some of the deals that I've looked at over the last few years that are re-entering the market for various reasons. But yeah, I think there's going to be some interesting opportunities coming down the pike in the next, call it 6 to 12 months, as bridge debt starts to come due and they need to refinance and realize they can't refinance into agency debt because they don't have the debt service ratio or they aren't occupied at the level necessary. Right. So, but if you can make a deal work in this market with these rates, it should be a slam dunk, because odds are in a couple of years, if you want to refinance, you're going to be able to refinance into a lower interest rate, which is the opposite of what we typically underwrite for. Typically, we underwrite an escalation in interest rates. So it could be super interesting. And then if you think about kind of getting outside of Rochester, what kind of areas have you targeted or thought about targeting for maybe some of your larger investments?
That's a really good question. Obviously, the ones that everybody talks about all the time, Texas, Arizona, the Sun Belt, but I'm going to be pretty picky about my underwriting and about what I actually buy. So yeah. I think until I get on the ground and I can explore, I know Tucson pretty well. That would probably be one of the first cities that I explore.
Yeah, no, I like it. I looked at Tucson about a year and a half ago, just tertiary, because I was curious about Arizona just in general. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a very attractive market. A lot of people are moving there, I think. So, well, I want to kind of transition us to kind of the end here. I've got a 3-pack of questions that I ask every guest. So let's jump into these here. So what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey?
Well, when I first got hit by the real estate bug, I was trying to buy properties off the MLS. And my realtor at the time, his father was my landlord in college. It's kind of how I ultimately made that relationship where I got my broker's license. Going to buy a house from him. And, you know, he was going to sell it for like $100,000 to me. It was a fair price. I was happy with it. And then somehow I found out the contract from the auction, from the foreclosure auction, for like $40,000. And he was going to make $60,000 profit selling me this house. Thought of myself as a good client. I rented from him. I paid rent all the time. And I was using him for all my real estate sales. So they were making money on me on the sales. I was like, dude, no, I'm not paying $100,000. I'm going to pay, you bought it for 40. How about I give you 60? You can have $20,000. And he's like, no, Mark, if you don't buy it for 100, I got somebody else that'll buy it for 110. So your deal is 100. That is your deal.
I'm giving you a deal because I can go make more. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't take it well. I backed out of the deal and I forfeited my $1,000 deposit. And I had another house next door under contract with a $1,000 deposit. I backed out of that one too, because I was kind of upset with them for making all that money, you know?
Right.
And that was what really shifted my mind to like, okay, I can't be a retail buyer. I need to understand how these foreclosures work. Mm. I need to be able to go to the auctions and where you can really make some equity up front. And so that was like a pivotal point in my career where I went from like, oh, I'm going to be a real estate investor. I'm running around looking at stuff on the MLS to I'm going to take this seriously. And if there's good opportunities out there, I'm going to figure out a way to be part of that.
Yeah, that's definitely a good lesson learned that you can go find that same house for, you know, $60,000 less if you just do a little bit of work. So, no, I like it.
You've got to have the cash, right?
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, if you're doing a retail and you want to get a mortgage on it, then you got to pay the pony again and get that. If you want to go get cash, then yeah, it could make sense. What's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into?
I'm reading Traction right now. It's really good. Just read Who Not How. That's another really good one. I should have read those way earlier than I did. But once I got hunkered down into real estate, like I had this huge learning phase at the beginning, then I just started operating and I didn't really read many books because I was too busy in the trenches.
Yeah.
And this over the last year, I've come up for air and I've been reading a lot of stuff. So those two, you know, highly recommend. I like The Fountainhead if somebody wants something that's not real estate, but still is like about architecture and building. That's a cool book.
Yeah. A few people on my podcast have mentioned Who Not How, and I need to, I think I've added it to my kind of Audible list. I just need to get a chance to listen to it. So, all right, last question here. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you can live an amazing life just off of passive income from your investments, what would you do?
I'd probably go to the beach a lot, scuba dive, probably learn how to surf. So I've never surfed before. I like to ski. I like to hike. Now, my son and I, he's 11, and I've planted this in his brain that when he graduates high school, I've convinced him to take a year off before he goes to college, and we're going to do the Appalachian Trail. So that's on my list. Yeah.
You're going to hike it, or how are you going to?
Yeah. Maine to Georgia.
Got it. Very cool. Very cool. Well, no, that sounds like a very cool adventure for sure. No, man, I appreciate you being on the podcast. If people want to reach out to you, learn more about what you're doing, maybe pick your brain about Rochester and some opportunities up there, how's the best way to get a hold of you?
Sure. My cell is 585-314-9790, 585-314-9790. I'm also over at Raise Capital, R-A-Z-E, capital.com, or you can hit me up on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Very cool. All that info will be in the show notes. Mark, really appreciate you being on the podcast. It was awesome learning about your story.
Hey, thank you so much, Justin.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.